So we're picking up, and we're going to this morning finish our study of Jonathan, at least as far as the story in the life of Jonathan goes. And next week we'll have our discussion questions, I imagine. That will take probably another service. But then we'll be moving on to another character, that is Rahab. And next Sunday morning, be on the lookout for handouts for that to kind of help you prepare for that study. But I've just found the study of Jonathan rich and fascinating, and it's been wonderful for me. I hope that you've been encouraged for it as well and by it. So as we think about Jonathan, who was the son of King Saul, the first king of all of Israel, we've kind of been following his life and tracking him along. And there have been brief interludes that I've inserted throughout the course of our study on Jonathan's life, because you understand how Jonathan's life and how his story is simply tied into David. The only reason Jonathan truly is brought onto the scene is because this is David's story that's being laid as a foundation for us. And David's life and Jonathan's life seem to be woven together in a sense. In fact, that's the phrase that you see repeated throughout the text, is that their souls were knit together. Okay, and we'll talk a little bit more about that in our discussion and what that is and why that might have been and how that might have come about. But Jonathan's story is kind of inserted into David's and helps lay the foundation for David, who's going to come to the throne. And so while Jonathan is our point of concern and the focus of our study, you can't tell his story without laying some of the foundations of David's life to just help us understand as Jonathan's story has moved along. And so we reached a point 2 weeks ago, I believe it was, where we're seeing Saul as he is chasing after David. Remember, Saul is trying to preserve his lineage. He wants Jonathan to be king. And Saul, on multiple occasions, has been rejected. He's been rejected for his disobedience by the prophet Samuel. And God has made it clear that your lineage is not going to be perpetuated on the throne. God has chosen a man from his own, like a man of his own heart, and he's going to be the next king. And despite that, Saul is warring against the will of God with everything that he can. And we see the pride and the hardness of heart and the anger and now the jealousy as he begins to realize that David is the man that God has selected. And he's doing everything that he can to kill David so that his family can maintain the throne. And so as we talked about it, last time I believe we talked, and as we were studying, we saw how David and Jonathan were able to communicate Saul's intentions for David, that it wasn't friendly, that it was rather harmful. Okay, Saul promises peace toward David, but yet makes multiple attempts on his life. And so they set up a plan where David would miss a three-day feast, and then Jonathan would communicate to the king, David's off worshiping God, and he won't be back, and I've excused him. And based off of Saul's reaction, they would determine whether Saul intended good or harm for David. And so, of course, Saul gets angry because he wants to kill David. He's looking for him, and he realizes David's in hiding, and Jonathan's in cahoots with him. And Jonathan then goes and communicates that by means of a signal where he shoots an arrow. And the phrase that he uses tells David that his father indeed does intend harm for him. So for the next several years of Jonathan's life, Saul, his father, is going to pursue David in an attempt to capture him and kill him. And we're not going to mention this. We do want one passage we'll read here in just a moment in 1 Samuel chapter 23. And I believe this verse, more than any other, shows us the heart of Jonathan. And if there was only one single verse that we could have to understand who he was as a person, I believe this verse would capture it better than any other. But for the next several years, Saul is going to be on the hunt, trying to chase David down and kill him. Now, this may help us a little bit. When you go to some of the Psalms and you see time and time again David writing and pouring out his heart before God as he says, there's only a step between me and death. And he's constantly saying, Lord, my enemies have surrounded me and it seems like there's no way out. And I'm a goner and I have no rest. And they persecute me without reason, without cause. You see those Psalms where David is crying out from this feeling of oppression. Oftentimes it points back to this time period in David's life when Saul is pursuing him and is trying to kill him. On multiple occasions, there are close encounters, and as you read through the narrative, unless God had not directly intervened, then Saul would have captured David and had him killed. Okay, and so God is directly involved, sometimes miraculously, sometimes providentially, regarding the preservation of David. And so, but these are where those Psalms come from. They're poured out of David's heart as Saul is seeking him and trying to kill him. And it gets so bad at one point in time that David goes and decides it's going to be better to live among the Philistines as a madman. And so he goes and he grows out his beard and he's frothing in the mouth and acting crazy. And he seeks refuge among the Philistines, believing it's better to be there among his enemies than it is to be among the people of Israel where Saul might be able to find him. So this is the last time Jonathan comes onto the scene alive while David is being hunted by Saul. And that brings us to question 8, and I'm just going to have to open it up. After our study's gone on this long, I forget where we are with the order. So question 8, anybody who wants to answer, feel free. When Saul was pursuing David, Jonathan went into the wilderness to do what for him?
Strengthen.
Okay, strengthen. Okay. And that passage is found for us in 1 Samuel chapter 23, verse 16. Tell you what, let's just go ahead and read these series of verses 15 through 18 of 1 Samuel chapter 23. And verse 16 is the point of emphasis that I find just such so rich in telling regarding the character of Jonathan. Now, when David became aware that Saul had come out to seek his life, while David was in the wilderness of Ziph at Horesh, and Jonathan, Saul's son, arose and went to David at Horesh and encouraged him in God. Thus he said, "Do not be afraid, because the hand of Saul, my father, will not find you, and you will be king over Israel, and I will be next to you. And Saul, my father, knows that also." So the two of them made a covenant before the Lord, and David stayed at Horesh while Jonathan went to his house. So what we see Jonathan doing is seeking David out and strengthening his hand, or encouraging him, as some translations say. David's been very discouraged up to this point. It's been brought to his attention. Saul is drawing close to him, and he's looking for him so that he can kill him. And because we're told that Jonathan gets up, Jonathan goes to David, seeks him out so that he can encourage him. And as I said, verse 17 really captures the loyalty and the love that Jonathan has for his friend David. And he tells him here again, do not be afraid. When he goes to David, this is how he encourages him. This is how he strengthens him. And I think about all of the Proverbs that talk about how, you know, a word that's spoken at just the right moment is like an apple of gold. And how wonderful and how encouraging and how uplifted David must have felt having received this encouragement from Jonathan. But Jonathan says, do not be afraid. The hand of Saul, my father, will not find you. You'll be king over Israel, and I will be next to you. And Saul, my father, knows this also. Four reasons, and this is not a sermon, but four reasons, just real quickly, that David encourages Jonathan in. He says, one, God's going to protect you. God is going to protect you. And David had to be wondering, because when you go and you read those Psalms, you realize that David was wondering, is God really going to deliver me? His deliverance was uncertain, it seemed. And David asked God time and again, are you going to? When are you going to? How are you going to? Jonathan goes to David and says, do not be afraid. Saul, my father, will not find you. He says, God's going to protect you. Jonathan believes this. Jonathan knows this. Then he says, secondly, you shall be king over Israel. This is, he is expressing faithfulness in God's promise to David. This is an expression of Jonathan's faith in God's faithfulness, where he says, I know God has promised you the throne, and I know that God is going to preserve you so that you're going to be able to keep it. He's reminding David that God had promised him the throne, and regardless of how dire the outcome may be, God is going to be faithful to fulfill what he has promised. Thirdly, he says, I shall be next to you. David didn't have to be afraid, because he had a friend like Jonathan. And it was Jonathan's expectation to see David as king and to be right there beside him when he took that position. And coming from a man who was, before David coming onto the scene, was crown prince, next in line to take the throne, I can't imagine the humility that Jonathan must have had to be able to speak these words to David. I know you're going to be king. God has made you king, and he's going to bring you to the throne. And he doesn't desire it like Saul. You know, Saul is ambitious and he's arrogant and he's proud. But Jonathan's humble. Jonathan's a good friend to David. And he says, when you take the throne, David, I'm going to be right there with you. And so it had to encourage David to know that Saul himself didn't even buy into his own campaign, because Jonathan says, Saul, my father, knows this too. He says, he's fighting against the wind. He's working against the plan of God. And for the life of me, I can't understand why it is that Saul labored to actively work against what he knew God's will was. You would think that a man who had communed with the Lord in the sense that he did, and who had known the Lord in the sense that he did, would submit himself to God's will. However, Saul refuses, and I guess that shows us the power of the hard heart, the power of pride, the power of ambition, the power of selfishness. Despite the fact that Jonathan says, Saul, my father, knows this, yet he's continuing to do this, it had to encourage David that Saul was not laboring under the delusion that he could truly withstand the plan of God. So undoubtedly, this visit to David in the wilderness would have encouraged him and would have strengthened him. And we talked a little bit 2 weeks ago about why it is Jonathan didn't stay with David here. At this point in time, Jonathan has to know it's not going to be very much longer. Yet Jonathan doesn't stay with David, but he goes to him and he encourages him, and then he goes back and he's with his father. And once again, it's his loyalty, his obligation to the nation. We talked about that. His loyalty to the people, his loyalty to his family, his responsibilities that waited him. For whatever reason, he chooses and he goes back to those rather than standing by David's side, because he probably believed also that he could help David more there as well. Anybody want to comment on this? Such a wonderful verse and such a wonderful insight into Jonathan. Dick?
I've got one thought on that question. David was living with a king, with all of the pleasures and everything of living with a king, food, place to stay and all that, and all of a sudden he's in the wilderness. That's a pretty tough deal. Most of us, well, I guess all of us, have a nice place to live. If all of a sudden you had to live in the wilderness, that would really be something. And David was looking forward to, God had told him he'd be king. We can look forward to a home in heaven. So that's one of the things we need.
It's kind of be hard to go from the top to the bottom, right? But there's what's undergirding that and what's sustaining him is faith and hope that he's going to be at the top again. And I kind of think about Moses too. You know, you talk about the man being there, having it all, and then losing it all. Well, Moses had it all, 40 years. Next 40 years of his life, he loses it all. He runs away, lives in the wilderness, watches after sheep. And then, once again, God elevates him to a position of leadership and greatness among the people. Kind of a similar story there.
Whatever our situation is, if it gets worse, we have a hope for something much better.
Right. Good point. So David here realized, yeah, physically he had a hope prepared for him that he was going to be made king. And we have an even greater hope that God is going to bless us with eternal life and will be forever in the presence of God. So good observation. All right, one final interlude before we have our last couple of questions. We're going to see David increasing and Saul decreasing. When you read chapters 24 through 30 of 1 Samuel, David's power begins to grow while Saul's power begins to decrease. Despite this, Saul continues his chase for David, seeking to put him to death. And yet on multiple occasions, you remember, David has an opportunity to kill Saul. Remember? And twice, when he's encouraged by his servants to go ahead and get rid of Saul, pull him out of the picture, ascend to the throne, you can take it, this is God giving you an opportunity. Twice David says, I will not put my hand against the Lord's anointed. Okay. Saul, on the other hand, did not heed to that philosophy. He was more than happy, if he could have, to stretch out his sword and to kill the Lord's anointed. God had anointed David king. And while David refuses to anoint, to kill the rejected king Saul, Saul is more than happy to try and kill David. Now, during this time, Samuel dies, and Saul's persecution of David becomes so great that David seeks refuge in the land of the Philistines. Saul is at war, and he's relied on Samuel's counsel for many years, not really listening to it, but going to him anyway and paying lip service to him. And so Samuel's dead, and so he no longer has this restraining thing in mind. And so what he does is he goes to the witch of Endor, a medium, and says, will you call up for me the spirit of Samuel? I need to ask him something. Okay. Now, the significance is, previously, it was Saul who drove all of the mediums out of the land. Okay. So he disguises himself, goes to this witch, and says, call up for me the spirit of Samuel. She does so successfully. I believe this is through the power of God, not through necessarily any ability that she possessed on her own. But the spirit of Samuel does indeed come forth, and he gives Saul the bad news. He says, you and your sons will be with me tomorrow, meaning that they will no longer be in the land of the living. So, unfortunately, we know that Jonathan loses his life. And who was it that was responsible for taking Jonathan's life? Okay, I kind of like how you tied that second part in there. The right answer is the literal answer is the Philistines killed him. After Jonathan's death, the Enduring Word Commentary writes, tragically, Saul's sons were affected in the judgment of God against their father Saul. The brave and worthy Jonathan died, as we might expect him to, loyally fighting for his God, his country, and his father, the king, unto the very end. And so we know that part of the purpose of God removing the sons and the family of Saul was so that he could pave the way for David to the throne. But we might also realize that it was something of a mercy, perhaps, for Jonathan's life to be brought to an end to that day. You see, Jonathan had plans to stand beside David when he took the throne. But God had other plans, better plans, for this noble man. One might say better to stand before the throne of God than to stand before the throne of David. And I also see another important lesson here. Dad kind of touched on this a little bit ago. Jonathan, while he was killed by the Philistines, he was a victim of his father's sin. And any parent or any prospective parent should take this idea to heart and probably has realized this in small ways throughout the course of their life. Oftentimes, fair or not, our children suffer for our sins. And that should cause us to think very carefully about the things that we do. Teach us to think carefully about acting with selfishness and acting with greed without thinking about how it's going to affect others. And oftentimes when we're caught up in a web of sin or a web of temptation, we don't think about these things, but it's important for us to remember that oftentimes those we love the most are caught up in the consequences of the sin and the judgment that we bring on ourselves, and that's what we see here with Jonathan. He lost his life because of the pride and the arrogance and the disobedience of his father. And after the death of Saul and his sons, a man escapes from battle, goes back and reports to David what has happened. Jonathan and Saul and his sons have been killed in battle. And upon hearing Jonathan's death, David breaks out in great lamentation over the loss of his best friend. And in the Song of the Bow, 2 Samuel chapter 1, how does David liken Jonathan's prowess in battle? Swifter than eagles and stronger than a lion. The bow of Jonathan did not turn back, swifter than an eagle and stronger than a lion. And this is a prayer of lamentation or song of lamentation after he had found out that Jonathan had died. We don't know the specific prowess that Jonathan had demonstrated. Obviously, we know that God's hand was with him on multiple occasions. And thinking back, I think it's to 1 Samuel chapter 14, where he raids the Philistines and kills that part of that garrison that's there. He and his armor bearer, they kill at least 20 of the Philistines that are there, but obviously Jonathan would have been trained and prepared for battle, and David praises him and his battle prowess. However, more admirable than the physical capabilities that Jonathan possessed as a warrior are the spiritual capabilities and the spiritual insight that we see. You know, he was a good man, and Israel that day lost a good man, and David lost a best friend, but God gained a faithful son. And how wonderful it will be for us to be able to meet Jonathan when we go and when we are with the Lord in eternity. Because doubtlessly, by his faith and his loyalty and his goodness, he is there with God. Anyone want to comment? I've got one more observation that I'm going to make before we bring this study of Jonathan, the study of story of Jonathan, to a close. Anyone want to comment on anything throughout the course of this? Okay, I found this interesting, and maybe you'll find this interesting as well. I'm pretty big on types and shadows as you think about things in the Old Testament that kind of stand as a reflection or a picture of something that is fulfilled in the New Testament. And I understand there's no specific, Jonathan was a type and the other person is a fulfillment. I know there's not that specific characterization in the life of Jonathan. But maybe you've picked up on this throughout the course of the study and realized this as well. Is there anybody in the New Testament whose life kind of seems to parallel a lot with Jonathan's, and that you might say Jonathan was the shadow to his type, type to his anti-type would be the correct term. Can you think of anybody whose life paralleled real closely with Jonathan's? Okay, well, maybe you'll agree with me, or maybe you won't. But as I thought about this and as I looked at this, you don't have to look too far to find, I believe, who it is that Jonathan's kind of pointing to, at least when you look at their lives side by side. Jonathan is something, I believe, of a type of John the Baptist. And I'll put that before you as a question simply because I don't believe the Bible says this anywhere. But I do believe there's a lot of similarities between these two. Like I said, I don't think it necessarily was intentional. You see that sometimes where Isaac was a type of Jesus. That much is clear. The Bible tells us that. But I kind of see, as I was looking at these two lives of these two men, kind of a shadow and a type and anti-type, comparing the two of them together. Let me just kind of give you some examples of things that I observed. One, both of these men were popular and loved by the common people. In Mark 1, 4, and 5, we see that John the Baptist was immensely popular among the common people of Galilee. In fact, it says all of the people of the region went out to be baptized by John. And people were coming from Jerusalem to be baptized by John. You know, we know that John the Baptist was very unpopular with Herod, but however, he was immensely popular among the common people. Remember when Jesus asked, I believe it's the Pharisees, the question, they come and say, by what authority are you doing these things? And Jesus says, I'll tell you if you answer a question for me, by what authority did John come? You know, and essentially, was he from heaven or was he from man? And the Pharisees say, well, we can't say he was from man because all of the people view John as a prophet. And so that kind of demonstrates to us that John was a person who was respected as a prophet and loved greatly by the common man. Likewise, Jonathan was as well. Remember where there's this issue where Saul's wanting to put Jonathan to death for a foolish oath that he made? And all of the people step up and say, nope, not today, Saul. All of the men of war come to stand before Jonathan and say, you're not doing that. So he's popular. Both were popular and loved by the common people. Both were expected to be a king. In Luke 3:15, we see while the people were in a state of expectation, all were wondering in their hearts about John as to whether he was the Christ. And so John and his preaching and his teaching and all of the things that he did to prepare the way for Jesus left the people of his day in expectation. Is this man the Messiah? Is he the Christ? Is he the one that's going to come and rule and redeem? And so he was expected by many of the people to be the Christ, to be that king. In 1 Samuel 20, 30, and 31, we see obviously that Saul's son Jonathan would be the one that the people looked to be the next king, to take the throne after his father died. And so both of these men were expected, in a sense, by the people to be king. Thirdly, both were willingly handed over, or both willingly and joyfully handed over the mantle of authority to one greater than themselves. Okay, both of them had power and authority, and both of them yielded that to someone who was greater than they were. In John 3, 29 and 30, he who has the bride is the bridegroom, John the Baptist says, but the friend of the bridegroom who stands and hears him rejoices greatly because of the bridegroom's voice. So this joy of mine has been made full. He must increase, but I must decrease. And so speaking of Jesus, he says, I've got to go lower in order for him to rise up. And so he willingly hands over his authority. You know, when they come to John and say, Jesus is baptizing, or his apostles are baptizing out by the Jordan River, should we say anything to him? And John says, nah, I've got to be lowered, and he in turn has to be exalted because he recognizes Jesus' superior position. And in 1 Samuel 18:4, Jonathan stripped himself of the robe that was on him, gave it to David with his armor, including his sword and his bow and his belt. And so I believe there's a sense in which Jonathan also hands over willingly the mantle of authority that he would have had to one who was greater than him, that is the man God chose to be king. Both of them died unjustly. John the Baptist in Matthew chapter 14 was put to death by Herod simply for preaching the truth, for calling Herod out on the sin that he had committed. In 1 Samuel 31 verses 1 and 2, Jonathan died in connection to God's judgment on Saul. Okay, and so he was put to death. He died in the battle, and certainly through no guilty actions of his own, but through his father's arrogance and pride, Jonathan lost his life. And then lastly, both were lamented for by those whose way they prepared. So remember whenever when Jesus in Matthew 14 received news that John the Baptist had been put to death, he withdrew from everyone. Okay, John the Baptist was his cousin, but he was also a great man, and Jesus esteemed him highly. I think 2 weeks ago we saw Jesus' commendation of John. No woman has been born who is so great as John the Baptist. He offers that commendation of John, and upon hearing of John's death, he withdraws, he leaves the crowds, and he goes to find some time by himself, lamenting the death of this great man who prepared the way for him. And then Jonathan is lamented by David when he receives word of his death through the song that David sings, the Song of the Bow. And Jonathan, who kind of forewent his position so that David could walk that road, both of these men were lamented by the one for whom they prepared the way. So maybe you see it, maybe you don't. At the very least, we're probably able to recognize there are some parallels. I wouldn't necessarily go so far as to push this as a type, but you do see a lot of parallels between the greatness of these two men. So this concludes our study of Jonathan. Anybody want to comment or question on anything? Dave, you look kind of like you might want to say something.
See both of them faithful servants. And they're going to do whatever it is that God wants them to do. They're trying to please God. And in the process of that, these two faithful servants are nailing down all these attributes, which we should all.
Right. And that's a good point. You know, we need to look at these two men, and this is not just a history lesson, a Bible history lesson. There's much to be gained here through the example of Jonathan. And we'll be talking about that next week when we enter into our discussion questions, some of the things here. But obviously his faithfulness, his loyalty, his love, his friendship, his commitment, his courage, his initiative, all of these things exemplify just a great man. And so I believe this was, I really enjoyed this study of Jonathan. I feel like I learned a lot about him, and I just got a great appreciation for him, and I can't wait to meet him when I get to enter into eternity and just talk to him and see him and hear him recount some of the things that he's done. All right, I know we're a little bit early. Dick?
I'm just going to say Jonathan would be a friend like all of us would like to have.
Yep.
I think you might have said that when we first started.
We'd all like to have a friend like Jonathan. And what do you have to do to have a friend like Jonathan? What do you need to do? Be a friend like Jonathan, right?
Try. Yeah. Yeah.
Try to be a friend like Jonathan. And we'll talk more specifically about that next week and the importance of friendship, getting into our discussion questions. So thank you for your attention in our class, and we'll be picking up next week and finishing out our study with Jonathan. I'll have the handouts for Rahab in the back, and I'll put those online as well for those of us who are worshiping and studying at home so that they can prepare for that study as well.